law review, and they're going to present the papers that they've written for an upcoming issue entitled Developments in the Law that is centered around the impact of the internet on the law and vice versa. First up will be Kathleen Hartman speaking on, or presenting the domain, no, I'm sorry, communities virtual and real, the social and political dynamics of law and cyberspace. In the middle we have Jane Krankel, who is talking about the domain name system, a case study of the significance of norms to internet governance. And I see several faces in the room that have been involved with the Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers, so that should be of great interest and hotly contested, or maybe non-controversial, we'll see. And at the end is the lovely and talented Mr. Bill McSwain, who's talking about the long arm of cyber reach. And afterward, they'll just briefly discuss their papers, their thesis, their arguments, and then afterwards, hopefully, we'll have some fairly lively discussion amongst people in the room.
I guess I was going to first just explain briefly how the piece came to be and what the development issue is, just so you guys have a sense of why we wrote this, and then basically give you an overview of what we were hoping to answer, or at least the questions we were hoping to explore in writing our papers. And then I'm just going to go through my section, and we're each going to present. We have five subparts, and we have three of the writers. Three of the five of us are here today. Every May, the LARB does a development in the law issue where we pick something at the beginning of the school year, back in September, of sort of an up-and-coming area of the law which we'd like to write about as a 2L class. This year we had a tight race between the internet and military justice, but the internet won out. So I think we were excited, you know, to be on such a timely topic, and it was really exciting for all of us to join on. So that's what each of us are responsible for, writing about 24 LARB pages on our subtopic, and are supposed to all fit together. Oh, this is Bobby Bartlett, who's another of the DEGO authors. Oh, and I should also mention that we are all under the guidance of Phil Bone, who is our DEGO chair, who's kind of coordinated our efforts throughout the year, and we're very grateful to him. So, I guess the way we ended up, I remember we had a brainstorming session actually with Professor Nesson and Jonathan, and we were sitting around, and we kind of were thinking about how we wanted to do this. We wanted to break this down into five different, you know, ways to get IP issues on the internet, or this or that. We weren't quite sure how to take it, but we kept coming back to sort of a little bit of a bigger picture thing, take a step back. I think we each present five different lenses of sort of ways just to kind of taking a topic and mining community, you know, and other people have their own topics, and just a way to kind of look at what's going on online and what's going on with the sort of the first laws we're seeing relating to the internet and the first cases, and they'll just take a step back and use these different lenses to kind of better understand what's going on there, and to hopefully give a little bit of insight into some of the activities that have been going online to people that aren't as familiar with it as I'm sure many of you are. You guys keep on top of things like cyber journals and think about where we're going to put a broader leadership, people that might not know really think about people's issues, but maybe we can somehow make them think about them in a way that is a little more provocative and a little more exciting and a little more connected to the laws they tend to not see as being cyber related. So that was kind of our goal. It was really neat when I went on to, I did a few questions interviews earlier, and I mentioned that people were doing the judges, and these are the judges that are supposedly writing the opinions, and they hadn't been thinking about this stuff at all, like cyber stuff. And we're not sure if it's the best to think about it, it's totally cyber stuff, or it's totally non-cyber, and it's just a contract question. But the thing is, that was really notable to me, was that these judges hadn't started thinking about this yet. When I said cyber community, they didn't know I was, you know, we would end up in a lobby discussion within 15 minutes. So I think it is pretty provocative. It's kind of exciting. It's just the beginning of a dialogue, I hope. But it's hopefully getting it out there to a place where people that aren't as cyber savvy might begin to start to read it and think about it. And so far, people seem kind of excited to think about it once they start to have a term to talk about it. So that's kind of how we do it. I hope that's I'll just basically briefly really talk about my thesis, which is starting to seem a lot more unremarkable to me now as the months have worn on. But I have to say, I guess it's hard to remember what it felt like to not know what's going on online. And I remember, I've been up in John's office, and, you know, he took me into my first, like, mod or move. And I hadn't done any of these things, you know, back in September. I used email like everyone else. I wasn't particularly cyber savvy myself, but I had an interest in writing, and I thought this was a good topic. So it's kind of hard for me to look back and remember a time where I didn't think about what's going online in sort of a way other than sort of web browsing and emailing. But I think a lot of people out there in the real world
because that's what they see the internet doing. You go online, you see your Amazon.com, your email, you know, your friend, and then you're off. And so it's really interesting to kind of start to think about the other more sophisticated interactions that are enabled inside those things, things that are enabled and that other past communication technologies haven't enabled, so there's a broadcast model, or even just one-to-one, the telephone, and things like that. But the sort of the capacity of the current internet as the architecture allows you to get on there and start to really interact in more sophisticated groups. And so I at first just introduced this idea of community and talk about it. That's even possible online. I talked to a skeptical reader at first. That's who I'm approaching. Someone that has no, would not be willing to immediately say, yes, community exists online. So I go through some of the more, the work that's out there that many of you, I'm sure, are familiar with, the Ryan Gold's work of virtual community, and just kind of start to talk about what the things are that are out there, what people have said about that. And after that, I start to talk about how that community, the communities we know right now, a lot of the guys that are approaching the problem kind of see that as the way the internet is. And so, like many of the other people, especially, you know, Professor Lustig, that has been writing about that, I've sort of challenged that idea that what we see right now is the way the nature of the internet, because you see a lot of the opinions talk about the sort of nature of the internet, this open, you know, public model of broadband, and that's just the way it is now, but that doesn't necessarily have to be the way it is, and so we can kind of explore how the communities we see now may not be the internet communities we see in 20 years. And my idea is sort of that these open public spaces may begin to be compromised as sort of proprietary interests take hold, and particularly as law, as it larger things of itself, and sees this other world as sort of a world that can make it itself without law having any role. But then I go into the third part of my thesis, that's in which I discuss how a variety of different cases that have come down so far. Thinking about this through a community lens is very helpful. I talk about some of the spam cases, some of the filtering cases. I touch on a title, actually there's a title line challenge to a single-sex discussion group out in California. I talk about all sorts of random sort of internet cases that have popped up so far, but I spend half thinking about them as sort of shaping how law in its various forms is shaping the sort of interaction that we have, that interactions that are happening online. If you think about it that way, there's much wider implications for a given case of saying, for example, that so-and-so has trespassed upon my server, which I know Bill will talk about even more. But beyond just that, you know, it's a simple trespass claim, a simple tort claim, it becomes something broader because you're starting to set the ground rules for how people are interacting inside the space. And so, I mean, my piece is somewhat descriptive. I guess it's not been posted yet, so you haven't had a chance to read it. But that's kind of how I approach the topic, and it was as well as the community. And I think it's just funny to me that, and in the end, of course, there's no huge earth-shaking thesis other than I think it's important to continue to look at this, using this lens, and so I just begin to look at these cases and not just see them as sort of these discrete cases of this or that, but to really start to think about some of the broader implications. And to try out different things, and just really not to sort of assume a fixed nature of how the community has to be. And also, particularly, I guess one of my ending conclusions was it would be unfortunate for us not to, but just simply kind of transplant our real space ideas right into cyberspace, because that might kind of not enable the sort of new interactions that are possible, all sorts of things about alien too, and things like that. So these are probably all concepts if you're these are probably also most new, but it just really was, it struck me as I presented this to people that haven't thought about these issues, but they at first had no idea, and when they started thinking about it, we talked about eBay, and who could regulate that, and what's going on online, and do you have a culture, all of a sudden you start to think about this really is shaping the way people interact during the day, and in the end, it kind of does impact our real estate lives, because they come back to these communities at night, and so if they, you know, you walk into a library, can you, what can you see on that machine? The first time I was in the library, I turned over and saw someone on the, you know, there's the four guys at the machine with the full, you know, pornography online, and kids walking around knowing about, you know, finding their books. I remember that happened once when I kind of actually got out of the ivory tower and went into the real world on a break from writing this. And these are really interesting implications about sort of discourses and sort of communities performing online and how that's impacting our real world. So that's how I wanted to think about it, and that's kind of what I hope to put forth in my conversation.
I'll go next because my section follows Kathleen's in the development. The background in my section was really formed in John's Internet and Society course, which I took in the fall, where we just sort of were looking at cyberspace or the internet sort of with these different lenses. And one lens that John sort of suggested was well, there's this big guy, little guy theme in cyberspace where big, little guys really have the ability to communicate to large audiences in a way that only big guys can do in real space. Like people who control traditional forms of the media, like magazines, newspapers, television, whatever, the average person doesn't have access to that media. But in cyberspace, you know, everyone, at least theoretically, has access to a worldwide audience, in theory. So thinking about that, I thought that that might be a good thing to think about. How would that sort of change some of the fundamental functions about current doctrine, you know, current judicial opinion? So I sort of narrowed it down to two areas that I thought it might have some relevance to. And one was defamation, and the other one was sort of the right to speak on private property. So I divided my piece into half. The first step on defamation is kind of more technical. Defamation is a little bit confusing, sort of what are the constitutional limits of defamation. You guys are probably familiar with, like for example, New York Times versus Sullivan, the case in which the Supreme Court said, if you're a public figure and you're suing someone over a defamatory statement, you know, you have to show actual malice in order to recover. And there are different levels, whether you're a private figure, public figure, whatever. So I just kind of look at that and see, well, the fact that this cyber reach idea that I call, I sort of coined that phrase. I was trying to come up with some sort of short, sort of maybe phrase that will stick in people's mind about that would describe this communicative ability of cyberspace. I call it cyber reach. So I just sort of look at the assumptions underlying defamation. And I really don't want to go into detail on that because I think that might kind of bore you guys. What I'd like to talk about more is the second half of my piece where I talk about the right to speak on private property. And I have a handout that I'd like to just give out. I brought 20 copies of it. I think it's going to be enough. What I did was I compiled some newspaper articles about one particular case that I wrote about in the Vivo. It was called Intel versus Hanidi. And I want to give you a little bit of background on the case. And the news article for your perusal is basically describing what the media has been enacting this case. And what the case is about is there's this guy, Ken Hanidi, who used to work at Intel. And the first article you see is an article that was in the New York Times about the case. I give you the most background on it, and then the other articles are bring you more up to date chronologically. So if you can just sort of skim those articles, and also listen, I'm trying to kind of boil it down for you. This fellow, Ken Hamidi, used to work at Intel, and he was fired. And sort of as a result of that experience, and also some other things that he knows about Intel, in his opinion, he thinks Intel practices employment discrimination and also just has these general abusive employment practices. And so what he did was, after he had been fired and after he had formed this group that he called Face Intel, former and current employees of Intel, and he started about every 3-4 months, he would send these mass emails to Intel employees. He was targeting about 30,000 people. And they're basically like 1-2 page sort of emails accusing Intel of employment discrimination and sort of advising Intel employees, this is what you need to do, for example, to guard against possible discrimination against you. You need to, you know, document the times when you talk to your superiors, or you need to do, you know, whatever. You just basically need to be aware of what Intel's employment practices are. So Intel obviously was very upset that these emails were getting through their employees. Like 29,000 people, for example, on one of the emails received this email. So Intel tried to block the emails. The first logical step is, okay, we're going to try to use our own blocking software and stop this guy from sending these emails. Well, that failed. That failed for a number of reasons, maybe just because it's just difficult to do inherently, but also he's pretty crafty. He's pretty cyber savvy, to borrow that mean phrase. So he would like send them in the middle of the night, or he would change his address or whatever. So they weren't quite sure when these emails were going to come through. So he successfully got these things through 6 times. Well, on the 6th time, Intel brought suit in court in California Superior State Court, trying to get an injunction against this guy, saying you can't send these emails anymore because it's disruptive. It's messing with our employee productivity. You're burdening our computer system. You know, et cetera, et cetera. So, as I was thinking about, there are some there are some analogies you can draw in this case to some other commercial spamming cases, which is how I first got interested in this, where you have these commercial spammers, like Cyber Promotions has had a couple cases, where they're sending like literally a couple million emails a day to like America Online subscribers and completely shutting down these computer systems because they can't swallow all these emails. So Intel's trying to make this analogy, say, look, this is just a regular old spamming case, and that's what the articles, I think, say that Intel's position are. But this case is very different, I think, and that's why I got interested in it. I wrote about it, and I think it's different for a couple of reasons. And I argue that the court should not enjoin the media from sending these emails for two main reasons. First of all, it's not spamming in the sense that this is burdening Intel's computer system. The only thing that's burdening Intel here is that Intel is trying to block the message because Intel doesn't like the content of the messages. There are not enough messages here that's actually shutting down or burdening Intel's computer system. But more importantly, the content of the media's messages are arguably his speech of public concern, which the Supreme Court has sort of defined vaguely as being, you have to look at the content, the form, and the context of speech to determine whether or not speech is a private concern or public concern. And I apply that test and I say, well, first of all, if you just look at the content of this speech, I think it's clearly a topic of public concern because it deals with employment discrimination. This is not Cyber Promotions, you know, with sending out a get-rich-quick scheme to people, that, which is, you know, like, would be considered commercial speech, which does not have as much First Amendment protection, obviously, as public speech, or speech of public concern. So I think the content is ways in favor of the media. Then when you look at the form and the context, you can sort of make some analogies between the way the media is sending out these messages and what the Supreme Court has said about the internet in Reno versus ACLU, which is a famous case a couple years ago where the Supreme Court struck down portions of the Communications Decency Act, where the court was very, looked at cyberspace very favorably. I mean, it talked about how cyberspace enables the average person to be a pamphleteer or to be a town crier with a voice that could resonate farther than from any soapbox, I think is the words the Supreme Court used. So just sort of taking your cue from the Reno versus ACLU case, I think the form and the context of the way media is sending these messages also argues in favor that this is speech of public concern. So so in that sense, it's a speech that should be protected by the First Amendment. So that's sort of how, where I start out with sort of my premise. But then you have to look at the specific cases. And doctrinally, I think these cases fit right into the cases in which the Supreme Court has looked at speech rights versus private property rights. And those cases have arisen in physical space when basically picketers or leafleters have tried to speak on shopping center property. You may be familiar with some of these cases. The most recent one was the Pruneyard case in California, where student political leafleters are trying to hand out leaflets to patrons at the Pruneyard shopping center. And the shopping center wanted to enforce trespass laws. They said, look, you can't do this. You've got to get off of our shopping center property. And in that case, the Supreme Court said, no, there actually is a right for them to leaflet, but they didn't ground the right to leaflet in the federal constitution. They grounded it in the California state constitution. That's somewhat of a complication for me and my piece, where just coincidentally, this Intel versus Hamidi case is going on in California. This is a California case, so in that sense, it's good that Hamidi, in my opinion, is good that he can probably avail himself of the protection of the California Constitution. But I wrote the piece just looking at the federal First Amendment rights. I think the case is more important than just a California case. And then in other situations that the court has said, when you have these student leafleters, these picketers, if you just look at the federal rights, usually a shopping center owner's property interest trumps the First Amendment interest. So, you know, there's that tension there. You know, even looking at the doctrine as it is now, the committee really has a federal First Amendment right to speak on private property? I mean, definitely it's up in the air. But I try to argue that when you put the two interests on the scale, the private property interest versus the speech interest, the speech interest wins out. And part of the reason I think it wins out is when you think about cyberspace, what's the purpose of enforcing supposedly neutral trespass law? in cyberspace. Well, you're not enforcing trespass law in cyberspace in order to take somebody's body off of your computer system. Obviously, the media is not walking into Intel's border and, you know, taking a microphone and shouting at the Intel employee. He's just sending his messages. So what courts have said in the physical space context is when shopping center owners and the like have enforced trespass law, the shopping center owners are hide behind this idea, well, I'm not really trying to silence your speech. I'm just applying this mutually applied law where I can, you know, protect my public property. And just incidentally, every once in a while, it shuts somebody up. Well, in cyberspace, I think that supposedly mutually applied trespass law is for the purpose of shutting people up. It's not for the purpose of just protecting your property interests from the physical interference, because here there is no physical interference with the computer system. It's just they don't like the content of the message. So I sort of try to push that idea too, that courts need to think about what are the purposes of trespass law in cyberspace versus in physical space. That's just sort of an added wrinkle. I'm curious what your reactions are to this case. I've talked to people about it. I love to talk about it. So just from hearing my description and from maybe leafing through the articles, or maybe you know something about the case already, I'd be very curious to hear, you know, would you support this guy? Do you think that he should have a right to do this? Do you think that in general people should be able to send emails to who they want to, or should the private property interest in the computer system trump any sort of speech right? I mean, it's definitely up in the air. There's no judicial opinions on this, that's for sure. So what do people think?
Can you
go ahead
for a
question? Sure.
How does one define the burden on the property owner for these purposes? You say it's not a problem to shut their system down, but I can see lots of other ways to make it visible.
Well, the way the courts have defined the burden in the prior spamming cases, is that they've defined the burden as a trespass to challenge, they call it. And I'm not intimately familiar with the details of trespass to chattel theory, but it varies from state to state. It's a state law thing. But as I understand it, there has to be some physical harm to the private property in order for a trespass to chattel theory to work. And one thing that he argues is that not only should I have this right, irrespective of any harm I'm causing, but it's a tribal issue of fact whether or not I've even trespassed, whether this trespass to chattel claim should even work in California. I can't give an exactly precise answer on what the burden is, but there has to be some sort of actual trespass. And he's arguing that, look, I haven't even trespassed because these messages don't rise to the level of me with trespassing over challenge.
How do you distinguish from the spam? What is the spam?
Well, besides trying to distinguish it on the basis of the quality of the speech, because spam is typically a commercial junk solicitation, as you know, so I think that's definitely a big part of it. But also, what sort of got me fired up about the case when I first read about it was, to me it seemed such a tenuous analogy to commercial spam, because Hamidi has not actually burdened their computer system. The thing about spam that the courts have focused on spamming cases is, look, Cyber Promotions, for example, sent 2 million messages in one day to AOL and completely shut down their system, where they just overburdened their system to the point where now you get subscribers complaining, maybe you're going to lose subscribers because they can't access their email and the like. So I guess I define spam not only by what the message is, but also sort of the quantity of messages. And here, even though there's a lot of messages, 29,000 messages is a lot, it's not so much that I think it falls squarely into the commercial spamming category.
Yeah, we actually called the basis that we use was that they had sent out 2 million emails, relayed it off of our SMTP service, so they actually used our service and sent them out, and then, which caused a service problem, but also they had so many crappy email messages in the past that all the bad messages bounced back and filled up the SMTP server, And then we also have a claim from the people that use us as an incentive. They just happen to be our domain, we went to .com, which is a nice, cool, or .com thing, and they just decided that they would borrow it to sell one multi-level lightning or Chronos sites, and the other was free gas sites.
Well, do you think
people seem to be fundamentally different in that they actually created out their resources to send the mail out, and I got their domain name to send the mail out. This guy's always doing
signal
destinations.
I agree. And I mean, that's one of the reasons I got interested in cases. I thought there were these principal distinctions you could make. And then also, I don't think there's any sense of media really confusing people. I mean, Intel has said, well, they've had employees complain about why am I getting these messages. But I think at this point, it's sort of like, I don't know, I hate this term because I don't understand it usually, but it's kind of circular, where they're saying, well, you can't say that people are confused by these messages because there's no precedent for them. As soon as you have a precedent that says, well, you know, yeah, people at the places where can receive messages from people like me, then people are going to understand, well, okay, maybe this is a guy who's sending a message that he's upset about the employment practices, and this isn't, you know, coming from Intel itself, whatever. I'm confused about where it's coming from. You know, this guy is like doing something fraudulent or whatever. But Intel actually has said that people are complaining because they don't know the origin of these messages. But I think if the practice were more common, they would understand that this is coming from people that basically just have a beef with Intel. And Hamidi also, up front in his messages, they explain what the purpose of the message is. Very simple. And actually, there is a website that he has that has examples of his messages. If any of you are interested and you want to check it out, it's just faceintel, all one word, www.faceintel.com, where he posts all this stuff. And but it is true that some of the employees don't want to receive the messages. And in that case, maybe your answer is, well, included in all my messages is sort of the disclaimer that anybody who wants to be erased from the email distribution list can do so. Just tell me. He claims that 450 people have written back and said, I don't want any more of these messages, and that he has erased them from the distribution list. And I mean, I guess that sort of takes word for that, or that could come out in trial. But I don't see that as a major problem either. And I sort of draw some analogies to other Supreme Court cases where the court has said, there's actually a great quote that I kind of want to read you, I don't have it memorized, but where in the government at one point enacted a statute that affected a complete ban on certain types of commercial contraceptives advertisements. And the Supreme Court said, well, what this basically comes down to is it's an acceptable burden. It's an acceptable burden in the interest of free speech. Or the journey from mailbox to trash can is an acceptable burden to bear in the interest of free speech. And here, the burden is much less than that. The burden is not going to your mailbox and throwing stuff out. The burden is just hitting a keystroke or clicking your mouse. So I try to draw analogy to that as well.
That's an interesting point, I tend to understand. My team's a lot more of an overview of various areas, so I just briefly touch on this, but a lot of the spam litigation, and not all of it, I'm not familiar with all of it, has had these fraudulent aspects, but you could imagine a commercial speech case which did not have the fraudulent aspects. It's unclear to me how much of those, like someone abusing, attacking into a server and using that server to send a message in the first place, and these are all twisted together as a component of these commercial speech cases. So it's not just a commercial speech. It was also that these people use a variety of bodies, sort of seen as fraudulent methods to do that in the first place. And so I have a hard time. You have to separate out that strand versus the commercial speech versus non-commercial speech, and that's a different strand. But I think that's a very strong point that a lot of the early litigation has been extremely taxing areas that are extremely, it may do that. Those families seem particularly, fraudulent and or just like that's someone that you guys have found that kind of thing. In fact, you've been pretty bad to the standards.
I think the families have been rather unsympathetic litigants. And that's what the nice thing about the fact of this case, I think the media actually is quite sympathetic in terms of just the context surrounding this case. So I'm very curious to know what comes up. you definitely call that.
Did you come across any cases that was the restriction of the speech actually on a company's property? Because a lot of the shopping mall cases, you're really having the replacement of the old downtown, the old street, you know, where you could talk to anybody as they're walking by. Now you have this new mode for the mall, and there was even the dicta in those cases talking about that. But to me, cyberspace may not necessarily be one big public space. You may have some private areas. Intel's own servers and their own distribution, maybe. And there's some argument there that that's more analogous to somebody walking into Intel and passing out leaflets there. Did you come across any cases that discuss that line?
Well, Intel placed a lot of those cases in their motion for summary judgment. They filed a motion for summary judgment, and actually the judgment date just this past week issued a preliminary rule and denied the motion for summary judgment. But they relied just on those types of cases where they say, you know, just as you put it, that yes, cyberspace is great, but it's not really about cyberspace. It's about our proprietary solutions. So